Hidden Files.
One 100 years ago, wars were fought with tanks, rifles, machine guns, chemical weapons, explosive devices, etc. Well, fast forward, and wars have gotten much more sophisticated. And at times, the most lethal weapon is intangible. From misinformation, media campaigns to sanctions, the tools of war have changed to target nations and to cause upheaval from within first, and then add the more common hardware tools to the chest, like WMDs, IEDs, phosphorus bombs and missiles, and, you know, great technological advancement like those. Just as there are alleged rules to traditional warfare that are not followed, so are there alleged rules to this new form of warfare, not targeting civilian populations and not inflicting collective punishment and not committing crimes against humanity. These are all nice concepts, which are not always followed. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today we will look at a form of war which many do not understand the effects of, sanctions, and especially the unilateral sanctions regime of the United States. According to the United Nations, sanctions are meant to be used as a last resort. It says it is a response to stopping extremism, curbing smuggling, and massive human rights violations. However, what has been the norm of the UN is that countries which are members of the Security Council are not sanctioned, and the sanction of others depends on the political and geostrategic interests of Security Council members. Well, the main sanction regime today comes from the United States and its unilateral sanctions. Washington sanctions a country and pressures other countries from dealing with the targeted sanctioned country, usually by economic threats or even worse. According to the United Nations, a proliferation of secondary sanctions has resulted in a growing fear of sanctions and overcompliance, leading to serious adverse effects on the human rights of millions of people around the world. Secondary sanctions are intended to prevent third parties, states, commercial entities, and individuals from trading with countries that are subject to sanctions issued by another country. We will talk about the legality of these unilateral sanctions a little bit later in this show.
Currently, a third of the world's population is affected by U.S. sanctions. Since 1990, the U.S. has imposed unilateral sanctions in over 20 countries. Countries that try to have independent policies from the United States are the most affected. Countries like Cuba, which has been on the U.S. sanctioned list for 61 years now. Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in history until the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Iran has been on the U.S. sanctions list for 43 years. And now, Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. Then there is Venezuela, which has suffered for years from U.S. sanctions due to its revolutionary policies. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions.
I'd like to welcome our first guest to the show.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a peace and social justice advocate who became internationally prominent after her son Casey was killed in Iraq in 2004. She set up a peace camp near then-President George Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. She is an author and hosts The Soapbox on Substack.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Cindy. I'd like to hear your opinion on the way sanctions have been used to cause maximum pressure on countries and their populations.
Sanctions are supposedly put in place because the United States, the State Department, the politicians, the media, you know, whatever, this big class of propagandists, they'll say that so-and-so is killing his own people. So-and-so is a brutal dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And so the United States, they're, you know, and Cuba is a perfect example of this. There's been a blockade in Cuba almost as long as I have been alive. And they're supposedly placed there so the people will get so disadvantaged and so upset with their own governments that they'll rise up against their governments. But as you know, a victim living in a place where there's been really harsh sanctions, that's not exactly what happens. And it actually is harmful to the people. And I believe, and I've talked to many people in the countries that you mentioned, and I've been to Cuba many times, that it makes them stronger to stay firm against the empire, against imperialism, against neoliberalism.
Well, the irony of these U.S. sanctions is that the American people actually don't benefit from what their country is doing to others. So who's benefiting from this, Cindy?
The war profiteers, the globalists, the capitalists, they're the ones that profit. But we've seen here in the United States that even though it was a slow march to the collapse of our economic system here in the United States, especially since 2011, we've seen since the start of COVID, we've seen since the brutal sanctions put against Russia this year, that it is actually now starting to reflect here in the United States with gas prices and inflation, hyperinflation, the reduction of services, the crumbling of our infrastructure. So these sanctions are coming home to roost.
And any final comments that you have, Cindy, on this issue?
Many people are starting to wake up to that fact. And so while corporate media is collapsing, we're seeing the rise of alternative media and a rise of truth seekers. So there's still hope. And it's like talking person to person. I'm here in California at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're in Iran 10 and a half hours away from me. And we know, just like exposing the truth from real humans, real workers, real people who are experiencing, you know, the good and the bad, and how we can work together for peace and for economic security and environmental sustainability for the entire world.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy Sheehan, for being with us right here on Hidden Files.
One of the main messages broadcast about people, such as those living in Afghanistan, Venezuela, and Iran, is that they are suffering. We watch corporate media pump out story after story of the suffering of these people living in non-U.S. ally countries and tell how their pain, unlike that of people in Western countries, is the doing of violent criminals ruling their country without popular support. The part the media often entirely skips, however, is the role of the West in causing these issues. A role that can almost be summarized in a single word: sanctions. Sanctions are also known as unilateral coercive economic measures, which means that they are ways for, say, the U.S., to coerce governments of sovereign nations to give in to their demands. The U.S. has the power to do this because the petrodollar system gives the U.S. dollar elevated status as the dominant currency in the global economy. And due to its dominance, it can also punish other governments if they continue to do business with the targets of these coercive measures. In this way, American officials aim to either make the government of the target country obey them or make its people so desperate that they'll overthrow their government in hopes of improving their situation. And the U.S. has used this form of economic warfare since the 1950s. On a host of different nations, like North Korea, Cuba, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and others. Some of the toughest of all sanctions have been imposed on Iran, and politicians like Rudy Giuliani have openly said they are working because they make the people suffer. The biggest victims of this economic terrorism or people with rare diseases who cannot access essential medicines because of these sanctions and often die as a result.
Well, let me welcome our next guest to Hidden Files.
Alfred Maurice de Zayas. De Zayas is an expert for civil and political rights and has published 9 books on a variety of legal and historical issues. He has been visiting professor of law at numerous universities, including the University of British Columbia in Canada, the Graduate Institute of the University of Geneva, the DePaul University Law School in Chicago, the Human Rights Institute at the Irish National University, Galway, and the University of Trier, Germany. At present, he teaches international law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy.
Oh, welcome to the program, Mr. De Zayas. Let's start off with your perspective on unilateral coercive measures, otherwise known as sanctions.
What must be clear to every listener is that sanctions kill. I mean, sanctions kill just as much as a bullet. Sanctions kill when you siege a town, like the Nazis siege Leningrad, that cost between 700 and 1 million human lives. Now, the sanctions that the United States has imposed on Venezuela are estimated to have cost, in the year 2018 alone, 40,000 deaths. Now, when you add all the deaths attributable to unilateral coercive measures against Cuba, against Nicaragua, against Venezuela, against Syria, against Iran, you're going to go into the hundreds of thousands of deaths. And this is not an exaggeration. UNICEF carried out an investigation of sanctions against Iraq back in the 1990s. And the estimate is that 500,000 children died because of the sanctions.
Wow, unbelievable. I mean, you say that sanctions are killing people. Can there be international legal measures taken against these sanctions?
In the light of worldwide deaths, certainly of more than 100,000 human beings directly attributable to United Nations sanctions, this is a matter for Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. This clearly falls under Article 7 of the Statute of Rome, the Statute of the International Criminal Court. That is the article on crimes against humanity. This is what has to be argued in the General Assembly. This is what has to be argued in the Security Council. This is what has to be argued at DESA and all other United Nations agencies. We already have the excellent reports of Alena Dohan. She is the UN Special Rapporteur on the adverse impact of sanctions, not only U.S. sanctions, also sanctions imposed by the United Kingdom and by Canada and by France and Germany, et cetera, et cetera. They all kill. And that is so important that the mainstream media pick up on this piece of news. As I say, my American friends know nothing about this. They know nothing about the fact that sanctions kill. They assume that sanctions are there for good reasons to persuade governments to cease violating human rights. So the hypocrisy of it, the cynicism of it is mind-boggling. But that is the situation we are living in. So my appeal, which I made in my book, Building a Just World Order, is that this issue be before the International Criminal Court. But in the meantime, it can also go up to the International Court of Justice. Because the General Assembly, if you get enough votes in the General Assembly, so majority plus one, you can adopt the resolution elevating the question, the legal question of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures under the UN Charter, and elevate it to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion.
Well, what do you think the overall goal is for Washington and its sanctions regime?
Our government, there is what we term the deep state. And the deep state is made up of the military, industrial, digital, financial complex. Essentially, they call the shots. And they're making money. They're making plenty of money with war. They're certainly making a lot of money with the Ukraine war. And they're certainly making a lot of money with the sanctions. So the sanctions is a way, for instance, to prevent countries to do free trade and to buy cheaper where they can in the world. What sanctions have done, and people don't seem to realize it, sanctions have upturned, frustrated, subverted the benefits of globalization. Sanctions have essentially destroyed globalization and the supply chains and everything that goes with it. So that the United States, by weaponizing the dollar, is trying to impose on the rest of the world the U.S. imperial wishes. And as I said, I'm an American citizen, but I think like Noam Chomsky or like Jeffrey Sachs or like Dan Kovalik or Francis Boyle or Stephen Kinzer, who just abhor the weaponization of human rights actually to hurt people. And that exactly is what we're doing, but that with the complicity of the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Fox, and the others.
What can be done to counter these measures?
Until we realize that we are being lied to day in, day out, and that we are in the United States, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, we won't be able to make any progress. So what can we do? Certainly give it publicity in the General Assembly, certainly give it publicity in the Security Council, appeal to UNICEF to carry out an investigation of the deaths attributable to sanctions, appeal to the WHO to carry out an investigation of deaths attributable to lack of access to medicine. Similarly, an appeal to the Food and Agriculture Organization, and then elevate the issue to the International Court of Justice. Is this a crime against humanity? Does this amount to a violation of Article 7 of the Statute of Rome? I have no hesitation to say that it does.
Well, do you think that these unilateral sanctions help to create an alliance between those countries which have been sanctioned?
The mindset in Washington is still the mindset of the unipolar world. And the United States just simply is striking right and left and imposing sanctions and intimidating countries and actually engaging in terror against governments, and has an enormous responsibility, both civil responsibility and criminal responsibility, for the consequences of those sanctions. But there again, that is what I say, and what Richard Falk says, and what Jeffrey Sachs says. But that is not what you're going to read in the New York Times and in the Washington Post. And thus far, I don't see the American media changing. I see the American media as the spokes, as the spokesperson, as the sounding board of the Pentagon and the sounding board of the State Department. So don't expect any level of self-criticism inside the established media. You can read very good analysis in the so-called alternative media.
Are there any final comments you have on this, Mr. DeZayas?
You will see that there's plenty of Americans who think like I do. On the other hand, none of us is in a position of power. None of us is in a position that we can actually influence policy. And we can write our articles and write our analysis and hope that some people who are in a position of power will say, that makes sense. Why not try that? Why not shift? Why not try a different paradigm than the unipolar paradigm that we now have?
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files, Mr. Alfred Dezayas. As many countries continue to be affected by the sanctions regime, there's growing solidarity between many of the targeted countries and increased cooperation between them. These nations have had to be resilient and had to count on their own ingenuity to survive and, for many others, even thrive during these sanctions. And now it appears that the pendulum of global power is swinging, and it is heading towards the east. This should be a very interesting journey, and Hidden Files will keep you informed during this process. Well, it has been a pleasure being with you on this episode of Hidden Files, and hopefully you will join us next week. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
In Britain, senior Tories have rallied around Prime Minister Rishi Sunak amid claims that some Conservative MPs are plotting to replace him with Penny Mordaunt. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Press Association news agency PA Media has covered this story and tells us more. Senior Tories have sought to downplay reports that some Conservative MPs are plotting to replace Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister with Penny Mordaunt. before the general election. A source close to the House of Commons leader, Ms. Mordaunt, rejected claims of an organised attempt to elevate her to the Tory leadership as nonsense. Conservative former minister Dame Andrea Jenkins, who has publicly backed installing a new leader before the nation goes to the polls, denied that right-wing Conservative MPs were coalescing around Penny Mordaunt. Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg, a former business secretary, denounced the idea as madness. With many Tories increasingly concerned about losing their seats at the next general election, reports in the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph suggest MPs on the right of the Conservative Party met moderates this week to discuss uniting behind Penny Mordaunt if the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak faces a no-confidence vote. It followed a difficult week for Rishi Sunak, in which he came under fire over his handling of racist comments allegedly made by a major Conservative Party donor, and the defection of Lee Anderson, who Mr. Sunak had promoted to Tory deputy chairman, to the right-wing populist Reform UK Party. Penny Mordaunt, who was a contender in the party's leadership race to replace Boris Johnson in 2022, has not commented under claims, but allies suggested she was focusing on her ministerial role. Dame Andrea Jenkins tweeted, "Interesting to hear lots of media reporting on centre-right Conservative MPs pushing for a certain leadership candidate to replace Rishi Sunak. Having spoken with lots of my colleagues, no one seems to have heard or been pushing for such a thing." Noise about Rishi Sunak's position grew louder in Westminster this week, after Jeremy Hunt's budget failed to boost the Tories' dire polling figures and No. 10 Downing Street struggled to deal with the fallout from Frank Hester's remarks about MP Diane Abbott, which Rishi Sunak eventually condemned as racist after 24 hours of prevarication. While refusing to return the £10 million the businessman Frank Hester has donated to the Tory party. But a No. 10 Downing Street source said the Prime Minister is focused on delivering on his plan to build a brighter Britain. The plan is starting to work with inflation down, mortgages down, wages up, the economy forecast to grow and the boats down by a third. But there's more to be done. That's what the Prime Minister is concentrating on. In contrast, Labour leader Keir Starmer has no plan and would take us back to square one. The febrile mood within Rishi Sunak's ranks came as he ruled out holding a general election on 2nd of May to coincide with local elections, having previously indicated he will send the country to the polls in the later half of 2024. A growing list of Conservative MPs have announced their exit from Parliament, with Armed Forces Minister James Hippie, ex-party chairman Sir Brandon Lewis, and former Prime Minister Theresa May, some of the most recent additions. More than 60 Conservative MPs have so far said they do not plan to run, prompting Sir Ed Davey to accuse many of running away from the Liberal Democrats because they know that we can beat them in those seats. Speaking to the Press Association news agency ahead of his party's spring conference in York, the Liberal Democratic leader expressed optimism about nabbing Conservative constituencies across the southwest of England and across the whole Blue Wall, where it's a Liberal Democrat Conservative fight. Sir Ed Davey said, "The response we're getting is phenomenal. Lifeline Conservatives switching to the Liberal Democrats, which gives us great, great belief that we can beat many Conservative MPs whenever the election comes." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Senior Tories attempted to rally behind an increasingly beleaguered Rishi Sunak on Saturday night, 16th of March, amid claims that some Conservative MPs are plotting to replace him with Penny Mordaunt before the next general election. Former cabinet ministers Jacob Rees-Mogg and David Davis went public to denounce the idea as madness and bonkers, as did senior backbenchers including former vice-chair of the 1922 committee, Sir Charles Walker. With many backbench Tories, including some with healthy majorities, increasingly fearful of losing their seats in an election wipeout, accounts of a plot to oust Rishi Sunak surfaced on Saturday in the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph. The Daily Mail said MPs on the right of the Conservative Party had held talks with moderates about uniting behind Penny Mordaunt, the leader of the House of Commons, and anointing her as leader in a coronation in the coming weeks. Penny Mordaunt made no public comment about the claims, but her supporters said she was not party to or aware of any such plot, and that she believed the stories were an attempt by her detractors on the right to damage any potential challenge she may make in the future after a Tory election defeat. Several Tory MPs maintain, however, that Penny Mordaunt has been on manoeuvres for months, making clear she would be happy to visit MPs' constituencies and get to know their local party officials. David Davis, who is close to Penny Mordaunt and backed her campaign against Liz Truss in 2022, said the idea was completely bonkers at all levels and would mean calls for an election would become irresistible. "We need to fight this election together, and we won't do it if we're fighting each other," David Davis said. Whoever won such a contest would be the shortest-serving Prime Minister ever, even shorter than Liz Truss. Jacob Rees-Mogg said any attempt to hold yet another contest would backfire. "Whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad." The idea that changing the Prime Minister now would make the Conservatives more popular with an election in view is madness. It will be destructive for the Tories. Sir Charles Walker insisted a majority of Tories would ensure another contest or coronation did not take place. "It is beyond belief that sensible people in the Conservative Parliamentary Party would allow a leadership contest to happen," he said. "It will not be allowed. It is about a faction of the Conservative Party that thrives on drama and chaos." Several senior figures argued that far from being a unifying figure, Penny Mordaunt would actually be hugely divisive herself. They said her views on Israel, on gender and various other issues would mean most of the right would never support her.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jahad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawbid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You're welcome. We are still in the month of Ramadan, this blessed month of God, in which we try to, in fact, touch on some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start this episode with this question, Sheikh. A pregnant woman does not know whether fasting will harm her baby or not. Does she still have to fast?
Well, if she has reasonable grounds to fear that fasting would harm her baby, then it's not obligatory to fast. And if there's no such ground, there's no likelihood or fear that it might cause any damage to the baby or to the mother's health, which ultimately will have bearing on the child's health, then of course she must observe fast, because I've seen many women who are very strong, very sturdy, and very healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Fasting does not affect their health,
right.
And so they have to fast. It's not, when there's genuine fear that it might damage the mother's health and as a result the child's health,
mm-hmm.
Of course, she does not have to fast.
I see. A pregnant woman fasted, Sheikh.
Yeah.
When she delivered, the baby was found dead. It means that there was a miscarriage.
Yes.
From the beginning, she had thought that her fasting might be harmful, but she fasted nevertheless. Well, my questions are as follows. Was her fasting valid, first of all? And two, is she liable to pay blood money? Three, what is the ruling in her case if she didn't think that fasting would be harmful, but later found it to be true otherwise?
Hmm. Well, if she fasted even after she had reasonable fears that fasting would be harmful and injurious to her health or that of the baby, or she discovered later that fasting was harmful to herself or her baby, of course, then her fast is invalid and she has to perform in its qaza, of course. But the liability of paying the blood money depends upon proving that her fasting caused the death of the fetus. You know, if it is established that it was because of the mother fasting that the fetus actually was terminated, it was destroyed, or it resulted in the death of the fetus, then she becomes liable for the blood money. Otherwise, she will not.
Mm-hmm. And what about the other questions?
The last question was very much similar to the first question, actually.
Uh-huh. I see. Okay. Somebody asked, a lady, upon delivery, God Almighty blessed me with a son who's being breastfed. The blessed month of Ramadan is approaching, and at present, I'm capable of fasting. However, if I fast, my milk will
yes.
dry up, and as I have a, weak constitution, and my baby wants milk every 10 minutes. What should I do?
Hmm. Well, if there is fear, genuine fear, of harm to your baby due to a reduction caused by fasting, the reduction in the quantity of milk, of course, or maybe fasting might result in drying up the milk. The milk will get dried up. So in this case, she has to break the fast because it's necessary for the mother to take care of not only herself but also the child.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, of course, the mother has to give 750 grams of food as fidya. Because of not fasting and because of suckling the child and breastfeeding the child, she has to give 750 grams of foodstuff to the poor Shia Muslims. And also, she must observe the qadha after the month of Ramadan.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, after the break. Stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope. Deliver this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan. Ahi qulubana bil Qur'an. Halli layalina bil qiyam. Ahlan, ahlan bil siyam.
Hi, Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest and speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh, some physicians who are not truly committed to the Islamic laws or might not be aware of them, basically, forbid their patients to fast, claiming that fasting is detrimental to their health. Should their orders be acted on or what?
Well, you know, if the physician is not trustworthy, his statements do not, in the sense that his statements do not bring any confidence to the person who refers to him, and of course, he cannot, his words cannot be taken for granted. It means that whatever he says, that the patient should actually look at himself or herself to see whether he can fast or not. And she has, or maybe he has enough experience. Maybe the doctor tells him, you shouldn't fast, because many doctors in this time around actually want to suggest to their patients, to their clients, okay, don't fast because fasting is going to hurt you, it is going to harm you because you will get dehydrated and so on and so forth. Of course, if he is trustworthy, if he's sincere in his advice, then he can, and there's also a kind of fear that actually is there with the patient. He has to go ahead and break his fast. But if he is not, if he by way of experience, he understands that, okay, he can fast and fasting will not be harmful. I have seen many people who are suffering from diabetes. You see, in the month of Ramadan, they say they are in a better condition than they used to be, because they don't, you know, eat a lot of sweets or maybe sugary things. So finally, at the end of the month, they are doing much better than they used to be, actually.
But you know that those people who are suffering from diabetics should actually hydrate themselves with a lot of water. They have to drink a lot. So if they can't drink, especially in those areas where fasting becomes too long, like the days are too long in the summer, for example. Yeah.
But in this time around, you know, there's a hadith from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family. He said, "Sumu tasihu." Okay, you should fast and you will be healthy. If we trust this saying of the Prophet, then and we observe fast, of believing course, that fasting will have its positive effect
on
us. But
if they are sick already, if they are ill.
Yeah, that's another thing.
That's
again,
another
there's
thing.
There's, if you and are, it is, if your health is going to deteriorate, okay,
right,
and get worsened, then you understand it yourself.
Exactly.
Your personal experience shows whether you are going, you're doing better or not.
Sheikh, regarding the question that I asked you,
yes,
is being committed to Islamic laws necessary for the doctor's orders and prescription to be taken seriously by the patients, like for not to
it
fast?
It is not.
Uh-huh, I see. Not. Their only medical profession is important, right?
Yeah.
So if they know something, they know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's why His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if his advice brings confidence, and it's a kind of reassuring to you, gives you enough confidence that, okay, fasting may be somehow negative, it may prove to be
harmful for the harmful condition,
you should stop fasting.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mahmoud, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest this week here. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, somebody asked, my mother was ill for a period of almost 13 years and couldn't fast. I know for certain that what prevented her from this duty was her need to take medicine.
Yes.
Please enlighten us if it is obligatory for her to perform the qadha of these missed fasts.
Someone who is persistently and continuously sick and remains sick is not supposed to fast. And of course, fasting is harmful for such a person. And because fasting is going to endanger his or her health. Now, when it comes to this mother, as you gave the example of a woman who could not fast for 13 years, of course, if she remained ill throughout the following year, the ensuing year, the year after the month of Ramadan, until the next Ramadan, there is no...
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You're welcome. We are still actually in the month of Ramadan, this blessed month of God, in which we try to, in fact, touch on some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start this episode with this question, Sheikh. A pregnant woman does not know whether fasting will harm her baby or not. Does she still have to fast?
Well, if she has reasonable grounds to fear that fasting would harm her baby, then it's not obligatory to fast. And if there's no such ground, there's no likelihood or fear that it might cause any damage to the baby or to the mother's health, which ultimately will have bearing on the child's health, then of course she must observe fast. Because I've seen many women who are very strong, very sturdy, and very healthy. Mm-hmm. Fasting does not affect their health. Right. And so they have to fast. It's not, when there's genuine fear that it might damage the mother's health and as a result the child's health, mm-hmm. Of course, she does not have to fast.
I see. A pregnant woman fasted, Sheikh.
Yeah.
When she delivered, the baby was found dead. Means that there was a miscarriage.
Yes.
From the beginning, she had thought that her fasting might be harmful, but she fasted nevertheless.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrated. Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates.
in the limelight.
In the United States, former President Donald Trump confused Barack Obama for Joe Biden at a rally in Virginia on Saturday, 2nd of March, triggering further questions about the age of the likely Republican presidential nominee. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new poll by the New York Times and Siena College, a majority of voters in the United States believe Joe Biden is just too old to be an effective president. According to the poll's results, 73% of all registered voters believe Joe Biden is too old to be effective, in turn revealing spreading concerns about the 81-year-old president's mental competency. Among those who voted for Biden in 2020, 61% believe Biden's age will make him an ineffective president for a second term, with 26% indicating that they strongly agree and 35% indicating that they somewhat agree. The results of the wide-ranging poll, which were first released on Friday, 1st of March, are the latest blow to Joe Biden's election campaign, which has faced a barrage of criticism centered around Biden's age and widespread voters' fear about his ability to be president. At 81, Biden is the oldest president ever to seek re-election, though his likely challenger Donald Trump is only 4 years younger. However, in much recent polling, Joe Biden is usually trailing to Donald Trump, and he also faces high disapproval ratings. In response to whether Biden's age is such a problem that he's not capable of handling the job of president, 45% of total registered voters agreed in the latest New York Times Siena College study. Among those that voted for Biden 4 years ago, 19% said they agreed with the statement. Meanwhile, across all registered voters, 26% expressed that while Biden's age makes him ineffective, he's still able to handle the job of president well enough. Among those that voted for him in 2020, 41% agreed with the statement. In comparison to Joe Biden, 42% of all registered voters believe Donald Trump is just too old to be an effective president. Among those that voted for Trump in 2020, 5% indicated that they strongly agree, while 9% said they somewhat agree. Across all registered voters, 21% believe that the 77-year-old Donald Trump is ineffective, but he's still able to handle the job of president well enough, while only 19% said they believe Trump's age is such a problem that he's not capable of handling the job. The Business Insider has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump confused Barack Obama for Joe Biden at a rally in Virginia on Saturday, 2nd of March, triggering further questions about the age of the likely Republican presidential nominee who has made a string of such gaffes. It also comes at a time of similar concerns about Joe Biden. At 77 and 81 respectively, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are the oldest people to run for the presidency in American history. Trump on Saturday night, 2nd of March, in Richmond, Virginia, said, "Putin has so little respect for Obama that he's starting to throw around a nuclear word. You heard that, nuclear. He's starting to talk nuclear weapons today." The crowd reportedly went silent as Donald Trump referenced Barack Obama, who left office more than 7 years ago. it's the third time that Donald Trump has made the blunder in the past 6 months. The former U.S. president's other gaffes include confusing his Republican rival Nikki Haley with former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Nikki Haley, 52 years old, who has defied Trump and several primary defeats to continue in the race for the Republican nomination, has tried to frame herself as the younger, healthier option, referring to Donald Trump and Joe Biden as grumpy old men in her campaign advertisements. Trump's mistake came the day after Joe Biden twice confused Ukraine and Gaza as he announced that the U.S. would airdrop humanitarian supplies to Palestinians in Gaza who are dying of starvation due to the Israeli bombardment of the territory. Joe Biden said on Friday, 1st of March, "In the coming days, we're going to join with our friends in Jordan and others who are providing airdrops of additional food and supplies into Ukraine." He added that the United States will seek to open up other avenues into Ukraine, including possibly a marine corridor. A White House official later clarified that Joe Biden meant Gaza and not Ukraine. The gaffe had been changed in the transcript of his remarks. Questions about Biden's age have intensified in recent months. The latest lapse came just days after he was declared fit for duty at his annual health check. White House physician Dr. Kevin O'Connor said Joe Biden fully executes all of his responsibilities without any exemptions or accommodations. A New York Times Siena College opinion poll found that 73% of registered voters polled believed that Joe Biden is simply too old to be an effective president, including 61% of those who voted for him in 2020. Voters seem less bothered about Donald Trump, who is just 4 years younger, with 42% of those polled saying Trump is just too old to be an effective president. While criticisms of the age issue on both sides are laced with political spin, age-related cognitive decline is real. As a person gets older, changes occur in all parts of the body, including the brain. According to the National Institute on Aging, certain parts of the brain shrink, including those important to learning and other complex mental activities. Communication between neurons become less effective, and blood flow in the brain may decrease. Healthy, older adults can, however, learn new skills, form new memories, improve vocabulary and language skills. The National Institute on Aging is conducting research on so-called cognitive superagers, the minority of octogenarians and nanogenarians, whose memories are comparable to people 20 to 30 years younger.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Nowruz, the beginning of the Persian New Year,